Every Woman is a feminist show about women and girls making a difference and the men who support us. As 50% of humanity and 53% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, KKFI, staff, volunteers, board, or management. Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart in the studio with Una and Fiona Nowling behind the engineering board.
Hello.
Hello.
And Ann Pritchett.
Hello.
In the seat next to me, and across from me is Representative Jim Ward, who is from District 86 in Kansas, in the Wichita area, and who is going to be running for governor for the state of Kansas. Additionally, he is the House Minority Leader, so we're going to have much conversation today about all kinds of issues facing Kansans in this upcoming election and based on past policies.
Looking forward to it. Thank you for having me.
Great. And since Ann is our political guru...
Not really. First of all, we'd like to encourage people to call in. The on-air number is 816-931-5534. Call with questions or comments. I guess the first thing on everyone's mind, Jim, if you don't mind if I call you Jim, is why run?
This is an exciting time for Kansas. We unfortunately were one of the very first states to try the tax experiment that seems to be popular in the nation's capital. We've seen the devastation. It's inherently fiscally irresponsible, it's unfair, and it devastated our Kansas economy. But what's interesting about Kansas is we elected Kathleen Sebelius and then turned around and elected Sam Brownback. We're kind of like a petri dish of politics, and we're on the cutting edge on what's next. You have someone like Chris Kobach, who not only wants to continue the Brownback experiment, but to go farther. He said on many occasions that Sam Brownback's biggest mistake was he didn't go far enough. And then you have someone like myself who says, no, we need to continue on our bipartisan coalition building, repair, and improve Kansas. And that's what makes this an exciting time to run as a Democrat and as a Kansan.
I agree. It is exciting. I guess one thing that the voters here in the Kansas City area that we talk about a lot is, how, first of all, how important are the votes in rural Kansas? And what is your plan to connect with those voters? Because there seems to be such a divide between those of us here in eastern Kansas and western Kansas. How can we bring all of us together?
Well, first, every vote's important. Every vote, whether it be in a city, a suburb, a small town, or a rural area. We can't take any vote for granted. I think the biggest thing is whether you're going to be successful in Johnson County or Sedgwick County or Wallace County, which is the far western county, you have to talk about issues that people care about. And it's clear that Kansans want to talk about an economy that benefits everyone, that gives everybody a shot for a good job with decent wages and benefits, that everybody has an opportunity to pursue their futures through public education and health care. If you look in rural Kansas, one of their biggest issues is access to health care, why Medicaid expansion is so important for rural Kansas as well as urban Kansas. Water issues are important. You mentioned rural Kansas. It's important to realize that 40% of our economic strength is agricultural based. 13% of our workforce is agriculture. And over 62,000 families make their living in farms or ranches. It's a vital part of our economy. And I think if we engage that part of our economy and those voters, we'll be successful, because our message isn't just urban, suburban, but it also has rural components.
Well, one thing that I think is interesting is, I'm a city girl. Like, I grew up in Kansas City. But when I was little, and Sharon, I know you remember this too, the cattle trucks used to come up to Kansas City and the stockyards were downtown. And we all knew what happened there, and it was a big part of our education as kids. But that's not happening anymore. And I understand it's because they've moved the slaughterhouses closer to the ranches, which makes economic sense. And then we don't have the mills here either. You know, if you came up I-35 into downtown Kansas City, you notice there was a whole bunch of what do you call those, silos? Grain elevators. I'm sorry. Thank you. See, I am a city kid. I don't know the farm stuff. And they've come down slowly but surely until I noticed the most recently the last one is gone. So I think that might be part of the concern, is that we're not connected with the agriculture economy like we used to.
Yep, that's true. We've become more efficient, and our infrastructure, our roads and highways have made it possible to move the packing plants and the slaughterhouses closer to the direct production where the cows are grown, raised. And I think that's a good thing, but I don't think it means that we're not connected. I mean, the Kansas economy, one of many reasons, the primary reason was a poor economic strategy by the governor and the flawed tax plan. But also, the commodities market has been sluggish for the last couple of years. Prices are way low and they haven't come up. And that sluggishness has hurt all of the Kansas economy. We are connected. If we just don't have enough population that we can ignore whole swaths of our state. We have to engage the entire population of Kansas to be successful and competitive and create the kind of jobs for our kids and our grandkids that we deserve.
And I think when people talk about public education and people getting the chance to go away to college and university, they tend to forget that there is an awful lot of science and knowledge in modern farming, and that people actually go and study that at university. It's not just to depopulate the countryside and send everyone off to the towns to do some big city degree or anything like that.
Absolutely right. If you look at what we're doing in our agriculture, in Manhattan, one of the largest science projects in our state's history, the bioscience center that's being created to protect us from terrorism through our agricultural system is being created. And I think that'll have a ripple effect throughout the economy. We talk about schooling. We have to change the idea that anything less than a four-year Bachelor of Arts degree isn't really extra education or higher education. We have to engage technical schools, community colleges, and other ways for kids to express their talents. Particularly what I think is important when we talk about this economic expansion that I hope to create when I'm governor, you have to engage businesses to help develop curriculum. They're not going to decide how to teach, but they're going to say, these are the skills our kids need to have when they get out of school. These are the things that I want kids to be able to do when they go to work. And as we all know, the world changes so fast. Kids have to be taught to be adaptable and adaptable quickly. And the more we engage business partners in that process, I think the more they're going to, first of all, support public schools and be happy with our employees that we're providing. Too often I talk to small businesses as I go across the state, and they're saying they're looking for qualified employees right now. And too many kids are saying, I'm looking for a job. I think a strong governor could be a good bridge between that and help build that. I think that would be hugely important to our rural areas, as well as our urban and suburban areas.
I agree. That is a good point about, and in terms of the college education, some of the urban, I taught in the Kansas City, Missouri school district, and one thing they do there is they let the kids take classes at community college. So when they graduate from high school, they also have a two-year community college degree. So I was wondering if that appealed to you, and if you thought that was something that maybe some of our Kansas school districts should pursue.
Absolutely. And I know your viewers are listening would be surprised to hear that I was a big critic of the governor, still am. Many of his
programs. I'm shocked.
I just put that out there so people know. But I'll tell you one thing he was right about, which was the whole idea of connecting high school technical education with college technical education and trying to make that more seamless and let kids get credit for work they're doing in high school that's college level. I'm disappointed he never put the money in that made it more effective, but I thought his idea of connecting that is right. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. You saw in Missouri. That's absolutely something we have to be more creative. Kids don't come one size fits all. Yeah. And we need to be more creative in giving them the opportunities in school that let them be successful and pursue their dreams.
Well, you know, and one, as a teacher, I don't know how many politicians have made this connection, but we lost our VOTEC programs when No Child Left Behind took over our world because we're not testing those tech areas. And so the money gradually disappeared until now. I think it's just basically trickling in. And we're seeing that those are the kids that we've abandoned, the ones who would have gone to trade school or auto mechanic school or school in how to be a medical assistant, those short programs. And those were started at the high school level. So I think we've missed that. That's a huge thing, that huge mistake, in my opinion.
Absolutely. In Wichita, one of the – you could make a good living being a welder, working for the aircraft industry. I mean, I say good living. You're talking about $80,000 a year with benefits. And we created programs through our Wichita Area Technical College, partnering with our high schools and the businesses that will hire those folks to help develop the curriculum. That's a model I think we can take. Not everybody's going to be welding. In some areas, it may be nursing assistants, and we have a high demand. Think of nursing homes and other ways that we help our elderly community.
In child care, they had child care programs, teaching high school students how to work in a child care center.
Yep, absolutely. And I think we need – what really needs to be done is reinvesting in that bridge between the high school and the college, which is tuition assistance and that kind of stuff that the state should be providing.
Yes, I think that's definitely something we need to be looking into. And the partnerships are important, I think, because of the expense. Because those programs are all very expensive. So it wasn't surprising to see them kind of go by the wayside, but it was sad. How about taxes? I know that there's been some kind of a movement, and I don't know if it's still ongoing or not, to eliminate the tax on food in Kansas. And a lot of misinformation. I heard just the other day that Kansas was the only state that taxes food, but I don't think that's true. But we are becoming a minority number, right? I mean, isn't it more than half have some kind of a break? I know there's a break in Missouri. It's not a complete elimination of the tax, but it's a low food is taxed at a lower rate.
This is another area where Kansas is high on the list that we don't want to be. We're the number one state in terms of sales tax on food. We beat states like Mississippi, you know, on taxing food, which is
so when you say number one, can you explain what that
absolutely
means?
That means we have the highest sales tax on food of any place in the country. That's because we tax food at the same rate we do everything else on our sales tax. Mm-hmm. And that includes local and county initiatives. Some states don't have any tax on food. Some states only tax food at much less than other goods and services. And other states are like Kansas. They tax food the same way as all other goods and services. It's wrong. It brings in about $400 million a year in revenue to the state. Excuse me. What I hope to do, and I have voted to cut the sales tax on food just this year, earlier this year, as part of one of the tax proposals we tried to push, a reduction in the food sales tax. We need to begin to gradually reduce that and redirect where that revenue comes from so that we don't hit those people who don't need another tax on their back.
Yeah, and again, for the listeners that don't understand, those kinds of taxes are very regressive because you're a low-income person is spending a larger percentage of their income on taxes. So even though we all pay the same rate, it hurts me more if I make less than minimum wage.
And if you've got
or minimum wage
food stamps, does that also get eaten up by the tax?
Do they pay taxes on food stamps?
I don't know. That's a good question.
That is a good question. I've never thought of that before.
My guess is yes.
I know they have those red cards now.
Right.
And that's another thing I'd like to see just as a citizen. I'd like those to be more nondescript because we've heard from people who have other customers at the stores have made comments because they see the card. It's so easily identifiable.
But I think how it works is what we call food stamps or food assistance is just like money. And so they ring up the bill, which includes the sales tax, and then they pay with their card now. It's basically like a debit card that has a certain amount of money that's food assistance. And I think they pay the sales tax like everybody else.
So they're giving with one hand and taking away with the other.
Right.
And you know, here in Kansas City, a lot of us buy our groceries in Missouri now for that very reason, because we can.
Absolutely. But you're absolutely right. Think of it this way. If you make $100 a week and spend $25 a week on groceries, and then that tax pays on that amount of income, and you make $1 million a week, which some people do, and you spend $100 a week on groceries, you have a lot more disposable income to do all the other things like medicines and rents and utilities and everything like that. Well, you put incredible pressure on fixed income, elderly, on minimum wage. Too many people in Kansas make minimum wage only, and also those folks who don't have jobs. We have too many people who aren't working in our state.
Well, I think we can figure it's close to 10%, the tax, especially here in the Kansas City area, by the time you add the municipal taxes. So a $25 grocery bill, that's $2.50 in taxes.
Which doesn't sound like a lot unless you only have $100 a week.
Okay, but if you have $100 a week, that's 2.5% of your income, right, Taryn?
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Right. As for the other question, which is taxes in general, no one in Kansas, including me, likes to pay taxes. But we do believe that there are certain essential services that help the whole the community as large that need to be provided by the state. That basics are schools, roads, infrastructure, prisons, law enforcement. Those are things that we do better together as a community than individually. And so there's a cost to that, and what's called taxes. I think most Kansans agree with the three-legged stool, which is income tax that's progressive, that says the more you benefit from the community, the more we would expect you to give back so that more can benefit. Sales taxes, everybody's got skin in the game. And then property tax we typically have used until recently as for the extra stuff, which is why we vote for it. We want to build something special, so we ask the voters for permission. We want to do certain road projects, so we ask permission from the voters. When you take away, which is what the Brownback experiment does, one of those legs or significantly reduce it, you shift that burden from folks that have more resources back onto people who are working every day or are not working in order for them to get basic services, and that's the wrong way to go.
Definitely. That certainly makes sense when you explain it that way. You brought up prisons. That was another thing I was going to ask you about. What is going on in the prison system? Is this just because we've defunded it to the point that it just can't operate effectively? Is that what's going on?
Well, there's three things on that. And I think what you're talking about is this summer we had three riots.
It's just been kind of a mess.
Right. We had three riots where inmates were in charge of the facilities for short periods of time, and it was a very bad thing. And here's the first problem, is we put too many people in facilities. We're trying to deal with the problem in Lansing, so we started closing buildings in Lansing. We moved prisoners out of Lansing into other prisons across the state, and that created a bad dynamic or energy in those prisons. Two, we don't have enough court guards because we don't pay enough. We pay $13.50 an hour. And you can go to work for Amazon at $15.
I was just going to say, there's retail jobs that pay more than that.
Right,
and
quick trip.
It's probably a more pleasant job and a more pleasant environment as well.
Exactly. You don't have to hang around with murderers like the Carr brothers and be at risk. And so we have a difficult time hiring and maintaining those folks, and you put the combustibility of that increased population and the not enough folks there, and you saw a disaster. We took steps immediately. Myself and several other legislators, made a statement and pushed the governor, who did actually take action to increase the pay during the summer so that they could hire more people. We've talked to Secretary of Corrections about the mix of prisoners and how many are in facilities, and we're having a conversation about building a new prison at Lansing. All of those will help, but the tax experiment was such a constraint for so many years. The fact that we were able to repeal a lot of that will help us going forward. But it's a long road. We have to ask other questions. Just one point. We got to make sure that I'm an old prosecutor. I spent 6 years prosecuting in the largest DA's office in the state. And there are bad people. And we need jails. And we need them in jail. But there are too many people who are in jail who we can do more creative things to change their behavior and protect the community without the prison being the place of last resort. And we have done some of those things. I remember Tim Owens, who's a former legislator from Johnson County.
Yes, he was my senator for a brief moment in time back 10 or 15 years ago.
He and I worked on a commission to try to provide services that would make it less likely that if you do go to jail, you come back. Mm-hmm. Basic things, common sense things like a GED. It's like drug and alcohol treatment, mental health treatment. There are things we can do to make it more seamless. When you go to prison, every one of your, if you're on any kind of assistance or health care or any of that's severed. And so when you come out, you have no job, no health insurance,
no income,
nothing. And we can do better to transition. And those are the kinds of things that don't cost a lot of money, that are common sense, and can make a huge difference, not only what's going on in the prison, but also what's going on in our communities. Less likely that somebody goes to jail just to become a better criminal. They actually go to jail and change behavior. And then also we should do things before they get to jail so that that's not the place they end up.
I was going to ask you, because I know America is another of those unfortunate numbers, where it's virtually number one for the developed world for the number of prisoners per capita. And if there's anything we can do to reduce the number of people going to prison, like perhaps decriminalizing possession of marijuana in small amounts and things like that, some of the
social
victimless crimes.
That's another thing that we in America are high on the list that isn't a good list. We incarcerate more people than anyone else in the world per capita. And let's talk first of all about marijuana. I have already voted to make hemp oil, which is marijuana without the high, available. It's hugely effective in like child seizure disorders, and tried to get that through. I support medical marijuana being legalized, and my mind is open about recreational. I know we've got a test case going on in Colorado. I think Massachusetts or Connecticut, one of the eastern states, just made it legal. And I think Washington, one of the western. So we're going to have a lot of information over the next 4 years that Kansas should use and make appropriate. I voted to reduce the kind of penalties that would let somebody for small amounts of marijuana go to prison. That didn't make any sense. So there's a lot of things we can do in that area to reduce the number of people going in for crimes. But I got to tell you, and I don't know how to resolve this yet, but in my district, which is a working blue collar, middle class district, one of the things that frustrates them is burglary and thefts. Mm-hmm. People breaking into their house, taking their stuff, and you think, well, nobody got hurt, but people feel violated. I mean, they're home, they were in there touching my stuff, and how do we balance that need to resolve that feeling of being violated? And still, these typically are drug-related. They're just stealing stuff to sell.
To support their habit,
right.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of questions, but it's not like we're dealing with rocket science here. There are a lot of smart people who have thought about criminal justice reform, and we should start having serious conversations about that.
You know, as a former teacher in an urban district, I had many students who had one or more parents incarcerated, and it was usually the father, and it was usually African American. And one thing that we discovered, the pattern was that on certain drug charges, they were automatic, and you would understand the terminology, so correct me if I'm wrong, they weren't state or local charges, they were federal charges. And when you're convicted in federal court, you go to federal prison. Well, you would think here in Kansas City, Leavenworth, you can practically throw a rock and get to Leavenworth, but no, they didn't put him in Leavenworth. They put him in Marion, Illinois. There was another one somewhere out in Colorado. And this became, I became very aware of this because I had two brothers who I taught for several years in a row and got to know the family really well. And once a month, their mother put them in the car and they went to see Dad, wherever Dad was. He was in Texas for a while, in Illinois. Most families are not going to do that. And I realize this is a federal issue, but if you look at recidivism rates, and they do say that one of the keys to a prisoner never returning is their contact with their family while they're behind bars. But if you take a man in a very poor family and ship them 800 miles away from home to spend their time in prison, they've lost their family, because it's just not realistic for most people to be able to go see Dad if he's in Illinois. But if he was in Leavenworth. Now, and I understand a part of that is because they wanted to remove them from any connections, from criminal connections here at home. Is that the reason that they did that?
I don't really know what the what I know is this, that our prisons are full, all of our facilities, and also we have trying to redo Lansing, which puts incredible pressure. But one of the things you mentioned about schools, and when you were a teacher, I have to tell a quick story about I represent an area that has one of the poorest areas in our state. It's the area just north of our aircraft plants. Mm-hmm. It was built in the early 40s as temporary housing for the influx of people who came in here to build.
And the housing is still there.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's called Plainview.
We have those neighborhoods up here, too.
Wonderful neighborhood. But their school, Colvin Elementary, in that area, is one of the most excellent performing schools in our district. We use money to be creative for those kids that have challenges when they come to school in terms of poverty and other indicators. We know that these kids can learn. They just need help.
Right.
But they've won awards, and so I was there. I've taken a number of tours, but this day I was taking a tour, and a little black boy of about fourth, fifth grade was touring. He was so excited, but he was really juiced up, energy going. And after about a half hour, the principal pulls me aside and said he had to kill his mom's boyfriend.
Oh, my God.
A month ago. And what's amazing is the first place he wanted to do was come back to school, because mm-hmm. that was the only place in his life where was anywhere near normal.
Well, there's stability there.
Exactly.
And stable adults and good influence. And adults that they know when they walk in every day that we're going to be there.
And that's what she was saying. That's why he's a lot calmer today than he's been for the last couple of 3 weeks. But that's one of the effects. And what I thought was important about that, other than the amazingness, that little boy's resilience and having to go through that, is how much teachers and schools deal with societal problems in addition to teaching reading, writing, right. and arithmetic, and how important they are to our communities in making a better place for Kansas.
There's many, many answers. One of the schools I worked at in Kansas City, which has now been closed, it was one of the 40% that got the cut 7 years ago. We were a very successful school, and we hit our test score mark. We were the only school in the school district, elementary school, that made those test score platforms every year.
Can we agree that tests aren't the only way
to
decide?
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other show, but yeah, that's what they're doing now. And
tests are not
it.
The only way to determine success in the classroom.
Yeah.
They're just one tool, just like all the tools in the toolbox, if you overemphasize one tool, you're not going to get a clear picture.
I'm going to jump up and hug you on behalf of all of my teacher friends. We've been preaching that for so long. But what we were able to do at that school, through a mix of federal grant money and local grant money, and then there was some Missouri state government money, we had what we called a community school, and we had a fully staffed health clinic, a dental clinic. We had a full-time social worker, caseworkers, and little things like mom needed to ride to the grocery store, and someone from the school was able to go over there and get mom. We had kids on medicine. They could go pick up the prescriptions, because a lot of the parents in that part of town don't have transportation, and we have the horrible public transportation here in Kansas City, so without a car, it's pretty hard to do anything different from your normal routine. But it was I do know, because I was really involved in this school. I was there for 13 or 14 years. It's very expensive. But I saw firsthand, if you are able to meet their needs, you can get so much out of these kids. So I guess we need to start looking for funding, because the scary part was the money. And every year we had to renew the grant every year. And, you know, we gladly sat down and did all that paperwork, but what a burden. We had so many other things to do. If we could just have a sure source of money. So you can take care of that. Once you're elected, you and I will sit down and talk about it. Okay?
Look forward to it. But what you're saying, I couldn't agree with more, is that there are so many things that go into educating a child, to give a child an opportunity mm-hmm. to pursue their God-given talents. That are in addition to reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Right.
And in order to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, you've got to address that.
They can't be hungry. They can't be tired.
And it's a challenge.
They can't. The police were in my house in the middle of the night for one reason or another. I had a kid a couple years ago that mom and dad were separated. My dad would come over in the middle of the night and bang down the door and beat mom up. And so we had to come up with a plan, because he didn't know what to do. He was the oldest. He had several younger brothers and sisters. And he knew that it fell upon him. So it was kind of hard. I'd like to repeat again that if anybody wants to call in and visit with Representative Ward, the phone number here in the studio is 816-931-5534.
You want to repeat that number?
816-931-5534. I think it's 816-931-KKFI, isn't
yes.
that?
Okay. Yeah, it spells out the radio station name.
That's really exciting. So let's get into the school taxes. I guess, you know, we don't have 3 hours. So briefly, what is your opinion on the current court battle? And what do you think the legislature will do that? And is it possible for them to have a solution that's going to satisfy everyone?
Well, let's start with, I agree. I am as frustrated with this perpetual litigation as anybody in Kansas. I've been in the legislature for many years and dealt with lawsuit after lawsuit. So I would love to get to the place where we don't litigate, where we are into the education business, not the litigation business. What I disagree with is the way to get out of the litigation business is to change the Constitution, because it must be the Constitution's fault. I believe that there are two basic requirements that we put in our Constitution, but are a demand of Kansas parents, grandparents, teachers, and students. which is we need the money to give kids the opportunity to pursue their dreams. And it shouldn't matter if you live in Shawnee Mission, Kansas, or Johnson City, out in Johnson County, out in Johnson City, out in Southwest Kansas. We should not play property tax roulette, which means if you happen to live in an area where the value of your property is high, you get a better education than if you live in a place where your property values are low. And I think those are two basic premises that the vast majority of Kansas believe are true. Unfortunately, the legislature and our current governor have refused to acknowledge that and tend to play word games and legal games. And what we need to do is buckle down, pass a method of funding our kids' future through public schools, and get on with the business of educating, get out of the courthouse.
I strongly agree with that, but when the taxes got cut so much and there wasn't enough funding for the schools, the local towns, wherever they were, said, well, let's put some of our money into them so we can fund them properly. And he tried to say no and tried to block them, and they had to sue to try and educate their citizens to the standard they thought they had to. And everyone, as you say, should have that basic right. But if they're not giving enough funding for that basic right, you should at least be able to kick your own money in or do fund drives or charity drives to help fund things.
Well, you know, there is one thing, though, I'm going to say that I think Kansas does right. And I've used this as an example for years because I live in Kansas, but I taught in Missouri. I'm retired now. Kansas elects their school board. And back in the late 90s, when we had the few school board members who embarrassed us on the national stage, and I won't go into details, it's my understanding that the very next time they ran, they were beaten and were no longer on the board. In Missouri, those school board members are appointed by the governor, and he's playing political football with it right now. It's really kind of a mess. So I will say I think Kansas has a better idea about this.
Well, to address your concern, that's absolutely what one of the first lawsuits was about, which is if you leave it just to the locals, every local school board will do the best they can to educate the kids with the resources they have, which is primarily mm-hmm. property tax. So let's use Plainview as an example, the one we just talked about where that school has award-winning programs.
Mm-hmm.
If they had to depend on the value of those homes to fund their schools,
exactly,
they would not be able to do that because 10 mils of property tax there wouldn't raise enough to pay half-time teacher. Well, let's move to Johnson County, which is for good reason. They work hard. They've built a good community, mm-hmm. but they're very affluent. 10 mils in Shawnee Mission would raise enough to probably fund an elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And that child in Plainview deserves the same opportunity to pursue their dreams. And that's what happens when the state doesn't do its job. Because as a state, we have that three-legged stool: income tax, sales tax, and some property tax. As a local school board member where I served for 4 years, all we have is property tax. So when the state doesn't do their job, the locals will continue to try to perform because that's what's expected and those kids deserve it. They go to the property taxes, and that causes a huge disparity, not based on the needs of children, but on the value of the property. And that's gotten us in trouble. The other thing that's gotten us in trouble is that we expect schools to provide a certain quality of student when they graduate. KU has a standard even to get in the door. Mm-hmm. You have to have certain grades. You have to have certain SATs even to apply. We require 4 units of math and 4 units of science. Well, you got to hire the teachers. You got to have the books. You got to have the science equipment. That all costs money.
Lots of money.
And when you do it that way, if you don't pay it, then that causes school districts to have a huge problem in order that this is what they expect us to do. They've only given us money to do 75% of that. How do we make the difference between what we need and what we have? And that's the other thing that gets us in trouble in the courts.
And Fiona says it's time for a station break.
It is indeed time for a station break. Thank you.
Support for KKFI brought to you by Californo's Restaurant. I'm Eddie Moore, host of the Jazz Nebula, the open jam session every Wednesday from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at Californo's Saloon on Mill Street. My special guest and I host an impromptu evening of Kansas City Jazz every Wednesday night. You can learn about reservations at californos.com, but they are not necessary. That's every Wednesday from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m.
Yeah, we're back on the air. Oh, we lost our caller. The
call
views. I'd like to reiterate the views, opinions, and commentary expressed on Every Woman are solely those of the host, guests, and do not represent KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, board, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. And our guest today is Representative Jim Ward, who's running for governor of the state of Kansas in 2018. And we're having several phone calls we're trying to get on the air. Anne, do you want to ask another question while we're trying to get those callers on the air?
This is kind of a big one, but I wanted to bring up the fracking in Oklahoma and the number of earthquakes. Now, I've been corrected over and over, so I understand that what we perceive, or I should say what I perceive as the cause of the earthquakes is not necessarily the fracking. It's something else that goes on. At any rate, I feel like this is something that we are doing as human beings. And can we put pressure on another state to stop an activity that we feel is harming our state?
The governor has a huge bully pulpit and has that ability to try to persuade. But we can do steps immediately. For one thing, we shouldn't be doing any fracking in the Flint Hills of Kansas.
Thank you.
That is one of the last pristine areas of prairie land in the country. It's a beautiful part of our state. The folks that live in that area have done a lot to preserve it, and we don't need to do fracking there. And we should. And another power the governor has that doesn't take legislative approval is the appointment of KCC commissioners. The
yes.
Kansas Corporation Commission.
Because they're the ones who make this decision, right?
They are the folks that monitor and regulate our energy production, from our utility bills to what kind of alternative energies and how they are paid for. That's a huge power. And can I just say, I live in Kansas. We have tornadoes. That's the thing we have. This whole idea of having earthquakes is just wrong.
I know. Have you? I guess since you're in Wichita, we felt one bad one here, and it's the first time in my life. It's scary.
It is a bizarre feeling to be sitting in your living room and have things just start moving, and it takes your brain a minute to think, "Oh my God, this is an earthquake," and it is caused by the fracking process, and I think it's the disposable water and how we deal
right.
with that. But smart people have indicated what causes it, and we need to take steps to, while protecting our oil energy production community. We have a significant energy
right.
production. We can do it in an environmentally sound way, and we should.
It's just really scary to me. I know when I was, my dad's family was from Goodland, and in the summers we went out to visit them, and as we drove, my dad would point at the farm fields, and he'd say, "That looks like wheat, but it's really money growing out of the ground, and then underneath it is more money." So, caller, are you there?
I am right here.
Hello, what's your name and what part of the city do you live in?
I'm Mary Kay.
Oh, and, hi, Mary Kay. She lives in Overland Park.
Hey, Overland Park, yes.
What would you like to ask Mr. Ward?
Well, Representative Ward, I was listening earlier to your conversation about schools, and I have heard a lot of people here in Johnson County at parties and so forth who just don't understand that it affects them if we don't evenly give out the school money. They're saying, well, we pay the high property taxes. That money should stay in Johnson County for our schools. I don't think they understand that it changes all of us if other kids in other areas are not getting a good education. And I wonder how you address that and how you help the people in Johnson County to understand that if some of their money goes to Wyandotte County or to
Western Kansas,
that raises the education level of all of our kids, which makes Kansas a better state overall. I mean, how do we get that across?
Well, you just did a very nice job, Mary Kay. That's excellent. That's a very good art. And I will tell you, Johnson County is one of the places that I point to show they get it. They understand how important public schools are to their economic
true.
Success. They invest their money. You watch the local school board races. You see the parent involvement. Johnson County gets it. So I respect their commitment and what they've done with their public schools. The only time I ever push back is that Johnson County isn't getting their fair share. We did all day kindergarten.
Really? Yeah. You don't think they are?
No, I do. Some folks tell me they're not.
Yeah, a lot of folks think we should get more.
And I point out that all day kindergarten happened this year, and the biggest chunk of that money's come, as it should be, to Johnson County.
And just this year, when most districts in Missouri adopted it, well, the district I worked in was the mid-80s. Right. So it's been almost, well, over 30 years since they've had all day kindergarten.
And all of the people who study education and brain development and child development say children can learn at earlier ages, and all-day kindergarten is a no-brainer. Not only that, we adopted an opportunity for pre-K to go and put money in, and Johnson County benefits there. We raised the amount of money that each child gets to go to school, the per pupil, and Johnson County takes a huge part of that, too. But you're right. It benefits all counties when we have an educated populace. The economy of the whole state is better, and when the economy of the whole state is better, Johnson County will do better because they have strong economic incentive. As I know, it spent quite a bit of money here getting ready for Christmas. You have an incredible economy going on here. So you benefit the whole state. That benefits the county. But I will tell you, Johnson County folks, most of their legislators are there when it's time to do the heavy lifting for a school bill.
That's really true. There were several that were voted. And you know, one thing as a teacher I tell people is that those kids in Western Kansas could very well move to Johnson County and have jobs here. And when you're in a nursing home and you need someone else to take care of you, don't you want them to understand the difference between milliliter and kilogram?
I have to tell you.
I mean, I do.
Our superintendent a few years ago had not a heart attack, but he went in and they said they need to go in and do a standard. And he's getting prepped, and the nurse who was prepping him goes, "Are you Winston Brooks?" which was the name of our superintendent. And he said, kind of nodded his head, going, "Oh, no." And she goes, "I went to East High." And that's a big high school in Wichita. And you know what he said? Went through my mind immediately. God, I hope we taught her measurements and how to count. And that's absolutely...
It's very true. It's kind of funny, but it's very true.
That's what education means.
Right. Well, what are we doing to help the folks in Wyandotte County? Because I know their schools have been really struggling.
You know, Wyandotte County has kids who bring a lot of challenges to school. They're doing... Cindy and her group over there are really doing a yeoman's work, but they have a lot of challenges. So when you cut the amount of money, Brownback made the largest single cut to public education in the history of the state. That has an impact. And if you're using the money on challenged kids, you're going to have a ripple effect. And those kids are doing some amazing things up there, but it's a challenge. Their kids, and like we said earlier, having represented a lot of schools that deal with kids who come with challenges, those kids can learn. A lot of them are very smart. We just have to find creative ways to teach them because of things they bring with them that other kids don't. And that's what Wyandotte County is doing. I think the investment we made last year to raise the pay of teachers so we can get good people to come back to teaching and to stay in Kansas is the first step. Because we all know the first and primary component of successful education is a good teacher.
Yes.
A good teacher can cover up a lot of mistakes in terms of not having enough money for books or not having enough technology or not having enough lab stuff. A good teacher covers a lot of things. And so they're making some good steps.
I just know that they made some dramatic cuts to their staff about 2-3 years ago.
It was horrible.
And because they just didn't have the money to pay them. And it seemed that they were, you know, as we all know, a lot of schools were. They were wasting a lot of time on testing and teaching kids to pass the test versus teaching.
Right. Well, Mary Kay, I'm going to thank you for calling, and we have to take
a
short
talk forever.
That's okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
we're going to take a short station break,
and then we'll be back to talk to Drew from Aletha.
Oh, yeah, he's back. Oh,
all righty. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Jaws of Justice Radio investigates how we can achieve justice from a system of laws deeply rooted in economic, political, and social inequality. We strive to dispel misconceptions created by the news and entertainment industries, as well as the fear-mongering of the political system. Listen in as we search out the tools needed to make our community a more just environment. Jaws of Justice Radio, Mondays at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
And we're back.
And hopefully we have Drew from Aletha.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Drew. Thank you for calling.
I was going to say, first off, good luck. And while we're talking about these issues, I think the first one I have to bring up is making sure the vote counts. So we need to make sure these, I guess I want to say election fraud is not happening when this election comes up.
I couldn't agree more. Every vote counts, and every person eligible should be able to vote. I couldn't disagree with one of my opponents more. Chris Kobach is the king of voter suppression, and it's not about fraud. It's about people who don't agree with him not being able to vote. The only thing I've heard in the last 16 years that I've been involved in the process about fraud was the mathematician from Wichita State who said, I see an anomaly in a few precincts that had a performance for Republican candidates that's higher than mathematically reasonable. So I want to look at those tapes. And the secretary, Chris Kobach, rejected that claim. Those kinds of things we should investigate, because there are two things that are vital to a democracy, that everyone should have a voice and their voice should count. And so I couldn't agree more. We want legal citizens that are able to vote, but we shouldn't make rules that just
discourage people from voting.
I was going to add transparency to that.
And I also wanted to just make a few more quick comments. When we're talking about education in the test, I have one word for that: Finland. Enough said.
Yeah.
And the other one is, in terms of this funding and stuff, when we get more funding back, I would also like to recommend, because we've seen the positive benefits in old age and people who are even, I would argue, younger probably, of people who are bilingual and trilingual and introducing it in elementary even, and coupled that with learning indigenous language support in those elementary schools all across the state, because the cost would be lower. And to the food tax point, I had a quick question. Besides revoking the food tax entirely on sales tax, do we know if it's been instituted back in to where, I know that Brownback got rid of people being able to, like, who were poor, to being able to submit their receipts in and get their taxes refunded? And I would ask if that's been remedied or it's still an issue and it's been gotten rid of. And I wanted to make a slight correction. I think Alabama might be as expensive as we are on tax. Maybe that's changed lately, but I remember a couple years ago I went to Alabama and their sales tax rate for food was outrageous as well. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you so much for calling.
Great comments, Drew. Great comments about the election process. And the answer to the question about whether or not you can deduct, I think you could use about up to $600 of your food sales tax at one point. No, that was not reinstituted with the repeal, but that is something we should look at. We should really look at the whole concept of food sales tax and how we can make it less onerous for people. And I wouldn't be surprised, but still, I'm not sure we want to be in competition with Alabama. I'd like to be in competition with those states that have the high economic output and do things that are very creative and productive for their citizens. Though I tell you what, Alabama did do a good job a couple of weeks ago.
They did.
In their election. So maybe we could probably
learn from them on voter turnout.
Well, I think that says a lot about opportunities in Kansas, because if Alabama can send Democrat to the United States Senate, we can send a Democrat to the Cedar Crest in a year.
Okay, so I've kind of saved the hotbed issues for the end. I do want at some point to get your comments on DCF. That's a division of Children and Families. But also the Me Too and sexual harassment, which is on everyone's mind, it seems. And we just lost a very promising congressional candidate here in the 3rd District of Kansas over alleged mistakes on her part. And so, do you think we need more laws? Do you think that we just need to support victims more? What is the answer here that you see?
Well, I think what's going on with Me Too and some of the things that are going on nationally, just bringing the issue out of the closet is huge. And like I think you mentioned transparency, I think that's huge. When there was some issues raised in the State House, I was the only one who took affirmative action. I said, first of all, every Democratic legislator is going to have sexual harassment prevention training. And we've already had the first round of that last couple of weeks ago. It was well attended, and the training was really good. It was done by the YWCA from Topeka.
Wow.
Two experts who have done it for businesses and other community sources. And the feedback from our members who were able to attend was good. It was, you know, talking about things that, you know, how different things are perceived. And so that was excellent. The second thing I said was, if there are accusations that turn out to be true, there are certain tools that I have as leader that I will use. Removal from committee, removal from travel opportunities, removal from joint committees. I also encouraged and went to the group that is oversees the legislature, Republicans and Democrats, called the Legislative Coordinating Council, and said we need to have an independent investigation of allegations. And then that once that's determined, whether if their allegations are true, then recommend punishments. And I think that would do a lot. Another thing that I think is important is we should have, if a man comes forward, they should be able to report to a man. If a woman comes forward, they should be able to report to a woman if that's their choice, because I think they might be more comfortable talking about these sensitive issues to someone of the same sex. There are things we can do to deter by education, punish, but we got to punish based on what the punishment is. Not all sexual harassment is wrong. Some is just inappropriate, boorish behavior, and some is criminal. And there's all kinds of stuff in between. We need to have a system that takes care of all kinds of it.
We do. You know, one of the things that disturbed me is one of the women who complained about Representative Conyers said that he'd blown her a kiss. So I think we need to define some lines here.
Yeah, and there are smart people who know how to do that in a way that makes that is educational, which is good for everybody, and also will deter people from acting in ways, whether it's just boorish behavior or actually bad behavior. You know, I'm not using the right words, but actual needs to be punished.
Right. And then criminal. I think some of this, at least right. What I'm hearing on the news, some of these allegations rise to a criminal level. And why can we do something to maybe lengthen statute of limitations on certain crimes? Or I know that they're moving towards that on some of the child abuse crimes because of the memory issues with adults.
Especially with the nationwide backlog of untested rape kits.
Yes.
I think if they don't have the funds or the will to test these and to prosecute them, then they should at least extend the statute of limitations, because the legal justice system is failing people there.
Yeah, and we did that in Kansas.
We did
expand the statute. And what that means, that's lawyer talk. There's a deadline for you to bring crimes, and it's based on the fact that memories are better the sooner after an event, and the collection of evidence is better the sooner after an event. The opportunity to deprive information in defense is better. But in rape cases and other crimes, we have extended that deadline so that cases that are old for various reasons can still be prosecuted. But you're absolutely right about the rape test kits, drug test kits, DNA. I was privileged to be the attorney with a team of prosecutors that prosecuted a man for a brutal murder of his ex-wife that used DNA for the first time in history of Kansas, and one of the first times in the U.S. And those kinds of things take scientists and laboratories, and that takes funding. And one of the things that the tax experiment cost us was resources for that. And we have too big a backlog, because what they do is take the highest crime first. So murders have priority, you know, and that's a problem. We're starting to reinvest, but that's a process to take a while. Now let's get to DCF. DCF stands for Department.
It's my big issue. Well, that and the Slitterbund slide, but I think I've given up on that. So tell me about DCF. What can we do?
DCF is the Department of Children and Family. They have a number of jobs, but their most important job is that's the agency that we have created to protect children who have been abused, neglected by their parents or caregivers. We're talking about sexual abuse, physical abuse, or neglect that it really is not just, you know, it's just very terrible. And our current administration has a deplorable record. I'm going to give you three examples. One is Evan Brewer from Wichita, who was murdered by the boyfriend.
And I tell people it happened to one of our state leaders. He was a mayor. He's running for governor. So this is not just something that happens to some people that we've never heard of.
And they did, the Brewer family did everything possible to try to bring this to the attention. And the child, that there was a child up here in Johnson County whose father killed him and chopped him up. And
that was Wyandotte County. Wyandotte. That's okay. But there were, I've heard four and I've heard eight different hotline calls on that family that were never acted on.
Right. And that is unacceptable. That's deplorable. Okay, that's the worst. Next, we find out that they lost 77 kids who had been entrusted to their custody that they couldn't tell you where they were at.
But, you know, it was okay because that happens. That's what was the social media answer was, well, that happens in every state. Well, does that make it okay? No, so does murder.
It's wrong everywhere rather than right everywhere.
Exactly. Well, we only had five murders last year, and that if you're one of those 77 children's family, you don't care what's happening anywhere else, but your child's lost. And the third thing that really can disturb me, well, we had evidence that they were discriminating against same-sex couples.
Yes.
And it was a very terrible way because we have a desperate need for foster families of good and caring people because these children are challenged when they come in. If you've been sexually or physically abused or neglected, you're going to have additional challenges other than just being growing up in a tough world. And we need families. And they were making decisions based on how the parents loved each other, who the parents loved, rather than what was good for these children.
Uh-huh. They actually took a child away from a lesbian couple who later ended up, I think, being killed.
The child, yes, that's true. And I'd have to look up this. I remember writing about that when it happened, three or four years ago.
Yeah, it's not that long ago. They were with a good, stable foster home, already attached to them because they've been there a while, and then someone said lesbians and gays and whatever are icky, we'll take them away and we'll give them to someone who's never been a foster parent before, and then they got abused and eventually, despite people trying to raise flags, got killed.
Here's the good news, and there is good news in this area. I spent, after I got out of DA's office, went into private practice. One of the areas I practiced in was in juvenile court. Mm-hmm. And I've been the prosecutor. I've been a guardian ad litem. I've represented parents, siblings, grandparents, foster family. I've had the privilege of doing virtually all the jobs in child need care actions. That's how children get involved with DCF. The system can work. It's always going to be challenged because parents are always the best place to raise kids. But when the parents can't do it, it can work. So 2 years ago, I started a crusade to reform DCF. I saw all this happening. And the good news is we got a post audit, which is legislative talk for an agency to investigate what needs to happen. I called for the secretary to be fired or resigned because she wasn't performing. And I called for the end of the discrimination. The good news is the secretary did resign.
Yes.
The new secretary prohibited zero tolerance of discrimination based on the relationship between the parents if they qualified as foster families. And we've begun a process of investigating whether DCF has enough people, enough resources, whether we should continue privatization, which is the system we use to provide services to abused and neglected children. Should we have more privatization, more contracts? So things are moving in the right direction. We just need a governor committed to making that happen.
Okay. Are we?
Well, we haven't asked the obvious question about where does he stand on women's reproductive rights.
And you have 30 seconds. Is that what we're going to?
I know he's just going to say he supports it.
I do. I fundamentally believe that everyone should make the decisions for their own health care, and for women, that includes reproductive rights.
Thank you. That's exactly the answer we wanted to hear, because we do try to focus on women's issues here on this show.
And we did. All of these issues are women's issues as
everything
well.
Everything is a woman's
everything
issue.
Everything is.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Representative Ward. Good luck with your campaign, and I'm hoping that our listeners will tune in next week.
And also stay tuned and listening for
Donna Wolf
with Urban Connections,
Urban Connection.
And then stay tuned for Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.